Ninja Mountain Podcast.
Welcome to episode 73 of Ninja Mountain, the podcast for artists and by artists. Ninja Mountain is a loose collective of fantasy sci-fi artists that like to talk about the art and business of sci-fi illustration. And I've completely bollocksed up this intro because I've lost my usual show notes because of a hard drive meltdown. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. The embarrassment does not, you know, doesn't really end with just this intro. So with us this week, we have just the two of us, Sokar Miles.
There's two of me now?
At goreblimey.com. And and I'm Jeremy McHugh, and I can be found at mchughstudios.com.
Oh, yeah, you're here, too.
Yes, I make two. That's right, the two of us, two. That's right. All right. So this week we actually had a few listener questions. Came to me in email, thankfully not lost. These questions came in after the loss of my hard drive. They come from Shane Smith, a listener.
I thought we were going to call him Horace Zabubala.
We could change Shane's name to Horace Zabubala.
I think we should.
Okay, Horace writes, or Mr. Shabubala, you know, whatever Sokar prefers here. For those that have worked a full-time day job and take on freelance work in their spare time, generally, do clients allow for the fact that you have a day job, or do they expect you to produce work at the same rate as a full-time freelancer? And I'll be honest with you, I'd say that it may somewhat vary a little bit. If you're not doing the work full-time, you may find that you're better working with publishers that are not full-time. They might have wider, larger deadlines since they're not as hungry for content and getting stuff out on a quarterly basis.
It really varies from publisher to publisher. But,
yeah,
you know, I don't think any of them actually care what else you spend your time doing. It's just that some of them have more forgiving timelines than others. For example, I'll get some people email me and ask if I can have something done in a couple of days, and the answer will often be no, because I have a job and I have lots of other freelance work stacked up, and it's just not going to happen, unless they're really offering a lot of money, in which case it might.
No, it's true. I would say, in general, I would say that part of the conversation doesn't usually come up. Most art directors, I think sometimes if you have a extenuating circumstance and the art director really wants to work with you, they may open up they may be able to open up their deadline a little bit for you, but it's not something that a company would generally seek to do. That you have their own deadline. If you're not able to meet it, then they'll find an artist that can. And I would hope if you're working a full-time job, that you would try to balance the amount of work that you take with that full-time job. Because let's face it, if you can't put in the 40 hours a week necessary to meet a tight deadline and produce your usual quality of work, then you probably need to cut back on the workload and be very particular about what projects you can take on. At least that was my experience. When I first started out, I was working a day job, and I found I was limited to working in the evenings, and my work suffered a little bit for that. And I was certainly limited as to how much work I could take on. But let's face it, when you work a 40-hour or plus job and you come home, you're just too tired to work. Oftentimes, it's not unusual. And I had to definitely adjust how much work I could take on based on my other responsibilities. So I guess long story short, it's going to vary somewhat depending on how understanding your client is. But in general, you shouldn't necessarily ask your client to make consideration for your full-time job, unless they themselves have that ability to be flexible when you can't be.
Yeah, I think the best thing to do is just look at what their deadline is and either do it or don't do it. It's best not to get into your personal life or what else you might be doing with your clients. And you can say something like, "No, I'm sorry, I'm too busy right now, I can't do that." Mm-hmm. It's better than just saying, no, I'm not doing it.
Or infinitely better than saying, "Yeah, I can do it," and then not deliver.
Ooh, well, that's not even an option. Don't do that.
Exactly.
Never do that.
Exactly. So I think that's a fairly simple question to answer there. Obviously, work within the constraints of your schedule and only take on the projects you can comfortably complete given your schedule. And hopefully, maybe once in a while, you'll find a client that's very flexible, given your schedule, and is willing to work with you, but don't count on that when you're running a busy studio.
And if you're doing, if a customer comes to you and they don't give you a deadline, you can suggest one yourself. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, especially if you do some private work that isn't for companies as well, you can say to somebody, if they offer you some work, you can say, well, I can do that for you. I can probably get it done within the next 12 weeks. And yes, they're going to realize that 3 months. And
oh, yeah. Just be realistic about what you can take on, given your working.
Either they're willing to wait for you to do it, or they're not. But be realistic and be honest. If you can be honest about what you can do, and you don't really have to get into what else you're doing all that much. Mm.
And one way to look at it, and I looked at it this way when I was working my evening. I was working as a waiter as an evening job at the beginning of my career, and I basically just said, okay, my current regular full-time job is in fact my busiest client, and I have to treat them like that. They have to be because when you go into when you leave full-time employment, you have to be just as wary of what you can take on in a given month. Let's face it, there are plenty of artists who overextend themselves and they end up falling behind on their work. So, I mean, whether or not you work a full-time job or you're just that busy with freelance clients, you have to find that balance and be professional about it. So, but anyway, well, we could move on to the next question. I think that's a fairly simple one, but it's interesting because it reminds me of some of my early days.
Ninja Mountain, heavy like rocks.
This one he was aimed mainly at Ralph because of Ralph's nationality, but Shane writes, you have dealt with clients based in the UK. Do you find there are many differences between US and United Kingdom clients? I'm mainly thinking about rates of pay, general business practices, and types of work offered, but anything else would also be great. And based on my experience, and Sokar, you've worked with clients on both sides of the pond, yes?
Oh, yeah, I've worked with clients all over the globe. They're all pains in the ass. I mean, they're all perfectly lovely people with wonderful business practices.
In general, I'd say I've never really noticed any difference in practice between working with a U.S. or a U.K. client. They're pretty much from the same pool. And oftentimes you'll find that even the U.K. companies, oftentimes some of their biggest markets are in the U.S., so you're going to find that some of their business practices are not all that different. There may be some peculiar differences, like maybe in terms of contract language, and certainly in terms of the currencies being used. But I've usually followed the same process between a U.S. and a U.K. client. It's the same creative process of working out the contract, payment schedule, and what have you, getting project details, producing rough sketches for approval, getting approval, going on to the final artwork, and then delivery of final artwork and payment. And it's really the same process throughout. I've never really noticed any distinct differences, except maybe UK clients are often very polite. What do you think? No? You don't think so?
I was just giving you the British workers so you couldn't see me, so you could just hear the raspberry.
I would say that they run the same gamut, the same spectrum of professionalism and product types as you find in the U.S. So, but no real distinct differences, and the internet has made it possible to work with people from all over the world. So what can I say?
Okay. I don't know. What can you say?
Nothing more. Maybe if we get Ralph on a future episode, he can comment a little bit more. Maybe he has some further distinct experiences that he can share that might not gel very well with what we say. He might have something to surprise us.
It's the Ninja Mountain Podcast.
Let's see. Also, Shane asked an additional question here, and unless you have anything more you'd like to add to the previous two there, Sokar.
No.
Well, Shane further writes, I have several styles ranging from fairly realistic to very simplified and cartoony. I enjoy them all equally and like the variety, so I don't think sticking to one style is an option, but I'd like to avoid a jumbled mishmash of art. So what would be the best way to present these styles online and in a physical portfolio? Would it be best to set up several portfolio sites, or would dedicated sections within the same site be enough? And he hopes that that question makes sense, and I think it makes good sense. What was your experiences in that, Sokar? I know you work in a fairly singular style.
My experience would mostly be secondhand accounts of other people's experiences, because I've never really had a website with... There wasn't much overlap when I stopped doing digital art and went back to doing pen and ink, mm-hmm. or when I originally went from ink to digital. So I never really had both on the same site at the same time, except in a very limited way.
Oh, yes. But they were distinct parts of your career, and when one began, the other ended, kind of thing?
Yeah, something along those lines.
Well, I mean, when you stopped doing digital, you pretty much stopped marketing that and just focused on the ink work, so...
Yeah, I stopped marketing the digital. I didn't want people hiring me to do any more digital, because I no longer had the equipment to do digital. Mm-hmm. I don't even have a drawing tablet, and I'm definitely not about to draw with my mouse.
Yeah.
So... marketing that would be a big mistake, because I'm obviously not going to be doing it anymore. It won't be offered, so why market it? Anyway, I've seen other people have success with both of the methods you refer to, and you know, I think if it was me, what I would do is if it was two completely different genres, like if you are doing horror and children's books. Then having two completely different sites, maybe even two completely different personas to go with your horror and children's illustrator.
Oh, sites. Yeah. Especially if you're, you know, let's face it, horror has a much more, oftentimes, has a much more adult flavor to it. And you don't want kids who, you know, I love this book. I wonder what other artwork this guy has done. And they go to that site and they find a horror gallery. Yeah, that's a bit of a, a bit of a turnoff for parents.
Well, I was actually thinking more of publishers than parents. I mean, kids love horror.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but you know, parents are watching where their kids are surfing and they find a site that features, you know, half nude vampire women next to a gallery of their favorite children's book.
I don't know. You know, my mother bought me a porno book for my 12th birthday.
A porno book?
Yeah. It's a Cameron of Boccaccio. It was illustrated.
Did she know this?
Well, yeah, she knew, but it's also a classic piece of literature. So,
well, anyway.
classic Italian literature, and porn.
So let's just say.
But yeah, if you're doing two kind of mutually at odds things, then it would be well worth separating out your personas and your markets into two completely different sites.
Yeah.
If on the other hand you're doing all fantasy, all sci-fi, all horror. All editorial illustration or whatever you are doing, and you simply have a variety of styles you can offer this in, I would say that you can save yourself some hosting money and just put them in some clearly labeled sections of your site.
Oh, yeah. So, and some web services allow you to set up subdomains, and that's an option, that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
But from my experience, I work, if anyone's at all familiar with what I do, I work in two relatively distinct styles. One is more of a adventure sci-fi fantasy style, kind of drawing more off of comics, I think, in flavor. And then the other one is much more of a conceptual, editorial, humorous style that has certain appeal to kids as well. Well, anyway, as I was saying, I work in two rather distinct styles, and they're very different. And I had to make a decision myself. I mean, do I go to the expense of an additional website, or can I find a way to compartmentalize for my site those two styles so that they don't conflict and cause confusion for prospective clients? And my solution in the end was just to set up two separate, clearly labeled galleries on my website. And when I directed particular clients to my site, I would directly link to either the fantasy gallery or the humorous cartoon art gallery. And I would just be fairly distinct about who I was marketing to in the with my emailing, for example. So, I mean, it's doable in either way. And My solution was that because I only have these two rather distinct styles, I didn't feel I needed to have to set up another domain for it. But it really is how it depends on how you intend to market yourself. And you point out some people might set up a separate identity for a style of work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a viable option too, as long as you're prepared to put all the, put your resources towards marketing two very distinct personas.
Yeah, you definitely would have to market yourself under both, but it's not that much extra work because you'd be marketing both your styles anyway.
Yeah,
like Jeremy was just saying, he's very distinct about whom he sends which section of his website to. So it's not that much extra work to market a whole different persona. And you can be honest within the art community that yes, both, Joe Flowers, the children's book illustrator, and Johnny Chainsaw, the horror illustrator, are the same person, but you maintain the two different.
Yeah, treat each as a separate brand. At least if they're that diametrically opposed, like if you're doing horror and children's books.
Yeah, that's essentially the way to look at it. It is a brand. And it's funny because I have done horror in children's books.
Yes, you have.
And it never even occurred to me that parents might be kind of shocked at some of the stuff on my site. But I don't have that much outright shocking stuff on there. So.
But it's all done in the same artistic style, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. So I think even if I marketed myself as two completely different people, people would know.
Yeah, you would have to be, his situation is such that he's dealing with multiple styles versus multiple genres.
Yeah.
But now, in your situation, you've got the one style, and I think one site makes sense as long as you very distinctly separate the galleries and make viewers understand that what they're going to find in each gallery is very different.
I haven't even done that. I actually have my site separated by... Actually, there's nothing on my site right now. I'm working on it. But the directory structure I have set up at the moment is I think it's separated into a couple of projects like Wind in the Willows and the Sumerian. Mm-hmm. And then there's categories for plants and animals and rats.
So yours is basically separated by subject rather than theme or
genre. It's all separated by subject matter. And I guess if you were looking for children's illustration, you'd be more likely to look at the Wind in the Willows category, for example, than the scary fauna category.
Given the fact that you work in two rather diametrically opposed genres, you might consider splitting your gallery between those two bodies of work and just directing people specifically. So,
Yeah, although I have to say, even my children's stuff is kind of scary. So maybe I should put an adult content warning in some of the pages. I don't know.
Well, I think it's our solutions are fairly simple ones. But one thing I'd like to comment on is that when he talks about having such a wide variety of styles, I might offer a small cautionary note on that. When I was first starting out, and this is before I even opened up my studio, I was starting to send out stuff for people just to kind of get a sense of what people were responding to. And I got actually a pretty decent bit of advice from Jim Pinto over at, who at that time was at AEG. I know that he kind of jumped ship for a little while and he's now back there. But this was back in his earlier tenure. And he looked at my stuff and he couldn't quite decide what my style was based on the samples I was sending him because I was working in different mediums. And it was causing certain stylistic differences that were kind of incompatible. Maybe maybe at the underpinnings of which was still me. I mean, the way I draw is the way I draw. But I think I was allowing too much the media to affect the final look of my artwork in terms of maybe using one set of tools created more of a cartoony look than another set of tools. So it was kind of creating a he. It made it difficult for the art director to know what he was going to get from me. You know, if he sends me a commission and he doesn't know what style I'm going to approach that commission with, that can be a bit of a gamble on art director's part unless you've had that really detailed conversation of what body of work the art director was interested in.
You know, I think most art directors are not too shy about pointing out what they want, though. I mean, I've had a lot of art directors say even something like, I like the color scheme you used in this picture. Can you please use something similar? Or can you make it like this picture, which I hate it because I'm not sure exactly what they mean. Well, so you ask for a bit of clarification.
Yeah. The thing was, I think the fact that I was exploring different media in my portfolio, it was creating a certain confusion as to what my personal individual style actually was.
I think that may have been a matter of, I think the key word there might be experimenting, though. I mean, this was a very early stage for you, right?
It was.
So even people who are only using one medium at a very early stage, they're often not, they won't have as focused a portfolio as somebody who's been in the industry for 10 or 20 years. And
yeah.
Well, has really
I have
developed.
To say, I appreciate that advice to this day because I realized just how scattered buckshot I was in my portfolio. I didn't focus it enough for the needs of an art director who needs to know what he is buying when he commissions me. So, I mean, when it comes to having so many diverse styles, you definitely have to find a way to make certain that the art director knows what he or she is buying and have that dialogue, especially if you have that a proliferation of styles, you know? So just a cautionary note. And another thing that kind of opens up conversation a little bit is we had an early episode, one of our first episodes, really, was a discussion of style with, we had Von Glitschke on. Do you remember that?
Nope.
Wow. It's been that long, huh?
I don't think I was on that episode.
Oh, that's right. You weren't. That was back in the, it was like the original four back then.
Yeah.
Let's see here. We discussed style, and one of the things I put forward was the merits of being a generalist versus a specialist in terms of your style. You know, what Shane seems to be describing, and I apologize, I've not actually seen Shane's site. What he seems to be describing is being something of a generalist, in that he works in a multitude of styles and will tweak his work to meet the demands of any given project, which is, you know, a marketing tool. It's not a bad idea to have that kind of that many arrows in the quiver. But at the same time, it makes it hard sometimes for art directors to discover what it is, you know, what will you bring to their specific brand? You know, when I look at how is your work individual? Does that make sense? Do you have being a generalist works very well, I'd say, on the local level, because, you know, let's fake it, a variety of local clients might want to have access to a wide variety of styles given from a single artist. But on the international, in the national stage, sometimes you want to tighten up a little bit so that you have a marketable brand.
Sometimes you feel like a nut.
Sometimes you don't. But yeah, does that make sense what I'm saying to you? What do you think?
So you're basically being wishy-washy and saying that whatever works for you, that's what you're saying.
Well, yeah, and at the same time, I think it could be very valuable to focus a little bit. Being a jack of all trades sometimes makes it you may find yourself indeed a master of none.
You might.
And it makes it hard sometimes for art directors. And I know no one likes to be pigeonholed, but pigeonholing actually does serve its purpose. You know?
At least it's even worse than being a jack of all trades and a master of none?
What's that?
Being a jack of one trade and a master of none.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, that can be kind of damaging to one's career too. Yeah. But anyway, that was just that's a neither here nor there, was I don't know if it strictly applies to what Shane is asking, because I understand Shane's wanting to be as broad in his appeal as he can be. But sometimes that can make it difficult for art directors to know what they're going to get from you. So you just have to make sure you tread that ground carefully and make sure that everyone understands what it is you're doing for a specific project.
You know what can also help? If you've got a variety of styles and you're applying for jobs, show the art director that you know what he's looking for.
Oh, yeah.
Send targeted portfolios. Don't send your entire portfolio to every art director. This applies even to people who have a more narrow range of things available. You know, you'd want to show the 4 or 5 if you're doing an email submission. Want to show maybe 4 or 5 pieces that really fit their brand.
Oh, yeah.
You don't want to show.
Yeah, I mean, basically, no matter how many, you could be somebody who's just a complete chameleon and you can draw in just about any style imaginable. But if you don't show an art director that you understand the needs of their brand with the kind of work you're showing them, then it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. Very true, very true. But yes, make sure the art director understands what it is you're offering. Make sure you brand your styles. I think branding is an important tool.
Yeah, like in Harold and Kumar Escape from Guantanamo Bay, when Neil Patrick Harris branded that hooker, that was great.
Cinema history right there.
It's just that was the worst movie I ever saw in my entire life.
Doogie Howser Goes Rogue.
It was on TV the other night, and I was just like, what is this shit?
I think I need to come out and say to open up another topic, and that is something that I will allow my embarrassment to be shared with the world, and hopefully they will learn from a painful story.
Yeah, you shouldn't get those back alley circumcisions anymore.
Yeah, it may seem like a great deal on the surface of it, folks, but we will just outline the story. Jeremy purchased a nice, shiny, new 24-inch iMac less than 2 years ago. The machine was running, I mean, it was bulletproof, just a beautiful thing. And it was running beautifully, and I set aside painting digitally for a while, and I've been working on, you know, traditionally. So I haven't been giving that much thought to the computer sitting on my desk. And at the same time, now, not long, here's where it gets funny. Not long after I purchased this shiny new computer, I had purchased a external backup hard drive, which remained wrapped and boxed, shiny and new, on my bookcase for all that time. And then, quite unexpectedly, my machine, less than 2 years old, decides that its hard drive is no longer to its liking and kills it in a very childish and selfish fashion. So I end up losing all that data, which would not migrate to the new hard drive that Apple was kind enough to provide me with under my warranty. So,
ouch.
Now, what we're seeing here, it's not unlike a fellow who's careening down the highway at 70 miles per hour on the back of his Harley,
who then his helmet's still open in the garage.
Then hits a pothole that's fully a foot deep, and his front tire just buries itself. And you go flying over the handlebars to find that your helmet is safely strapped to it. And that's basically what happened to me. I did not back up my hard drive, and I deserve to be mocked.
You know, I think we've all been there. I've been there. When I was living in Sweden, it happened. I'd made a mistake in the first place by letting the idiot boyfriend that I was with at the time pick out a computer for me. Mm-hmm. And he picked out this horrible clunker not even from a computer store, but from a gaming store.
Yep.
What was I thinking, right?
Yeah. So, he bought you a gaming rig.
Not even. It was like you couldn't play that many games on it because it was a real piece of shit.
Oh, what was it, like an e-machine?
I don't know. It was some crappy Swedish put together by a bunch of losers in the back of a gaming store computer.
Was there a coal bin at the back of the hard drive?
I don't know. There's a little hamster wheel in there somewhere. No, well, anyway, I bought all these. I bought all these DVDs. I was going to, or not DVDs. I bought all these writable CDs. I was totally going to back it up. I didn't. and one day the hard drive just stopped working. Nothing helped. Freezing it, sending it to data recovery place. Mm-hmm. Great expense. Came back with nothing recovered. So I still have the thing in case the technology ever exists. I can't even remember what's on it, but at the time it seemed like a huge disaster because I lost about a quarter of my print library. I lost two major commissions that I was working on at the time, and the deadlines were like on my head. And I had to not only get a new computer right away, but the day I got the new computer, I had to pretty much sit up all night getting these commissions done, both at once, kind of alternating between them desperately, because I couldn't just... I mean, you have to look at it from an art director's point of view. What are they going to think of an artist as all, oh, my computer crashed? They probably hear that every day, and it's usually not true. So you can't be the person who did that.
I have to say, I'm proud to say I've never played that card. I've never said my dog ate it, you know? But I have to say I freely accept any ridicule people have to offer, because it's not as though I didn't know better. I had my PC for years, and I used to back up all kinds of art files to CD, and I still have those CDs. But for some reason, I just felt perfectly safe with my current system, and I said, "Well, I'll do it next week, or I'll do it tomorrow." You always tell yourself that, and then you get any number of other things that pull you away from that particular housekeeping task. Until you realize that it was not a housekeeping task. It was a structural, you've got to rebuild your home kind of task.
Yeah.
You know? So it's one of those situations where I've had conversations with people and they talk about insurance. The thing is, nobody needs insurance until they need insurance, if that makes sense. No one ever thinks, well, you know what? I don't necessarily need to insure myself to the hilt. I mean... when am I ever going to need car insurance, they say, just before they get T-boned in traffic.
Well, I don't need car insurance. I don't have a car.
That hard drive, let me just say, that backing up your files is that insurance, and I failed miserably to insure myself against the damage.
Actually, you know what? Now that I think about it, I have nothing backed up either. Oh. I always think I don't need to because I'm a traditional artist. Mm-hmm. But then I think, wait a minute, how many of those originals do I still have?
Yep, now you have to rescan. I'm rescanning all my old artwork. I've already rescanned most of it.
I don't even have most of my artwork. I've sold most of it. So if anything ever happened to the scans, you know, I can't like track down the people who bought my art and be like, hey, can I borrow?
Yeah. So anyway, let's just offer this as a cautionary note, and I hope anybody who is as laissez-faire as I have been with backing up art files,
that I love they the way will, you pronounce that almost as laissez-faire.
Laissez-faire is the same thing. You know, if you've decided, well, I'll back up those files later, and don't put a timestamp on that later. You're going to be doomed to much the same fate as myself. Is very strong possibility. You know, I would say also that I've been left with is the ability to be philosophical about all this. There are a few things that make this not completely unbearable to me, what has happened. And that is, one, most of the files that I had were owned by other publishers. So about 99.99% of the artwork I was doing was owned by other publishers. So there's nothing more I could do with the files to begin with. Two, most of the other stuff was just, the only stuff I really lost in the end were the daily warm-ups, the digital pieces. But those are all existing as JPEGs on my website, so I already got my use out of those as I see it. So I've been very fortunate in that my loss was not more severe. I was not in the middle of a project for a client that got dashed. So let me just say, it was a cheap lesson learned. Let's put it that way. I didn't have to sit down and repaint a dozen assignments, so... I will just leave it at that and say if anybody else has had similar issues, maybe they wouldn't mind sharing it on the comments list just to make me feel a little bit better. Or at the same time, if you'd rather just kind of piss on my grave, feel free to come on in and berate. And hopefully other people will take that as a cautionary note and start backing up their files.
Ninja Mountain. Wild and free.
you know what? We had one other item today, and that was a gentleman. Who was it that wanted a critique of one of their entry? I know Patrick was very kind enough to.
Some dude,
Preston Stone, otherwise known as Razwit. He had produced his drawing for Art Order's Gotta Have a Hook Art Challenge. I'm actually part of that, too. I'm having a good time. I hope I can get it done before I have to leave for Gen Con, because the final deadline for the finished artwork is around the time that I'll be gone. But let's see here. Have you seen it, Sokar?
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. It's a squashed down dwarf standing on top of a warty crow creature.
Yes, that is a Hook Horror, a dungeon denizen.
A dungeon denizen,
popular in the Dungeons and Dragons mythos. Let us see here. And we have, he's just standing on top of its corpse, basically. And I'm looking at the piece, and I like the composition. I think it's a pretty strong composition. One of the things that I might, if I were to offer any negative critique or something more constructive than the fact that I think it's a really interesting piece, would be a few things. One, I think I would look at the lighting situation. I like the back lighting is dramatic, but at the same time, I think it kind of kills the strong silhouette a little bit. Do you see what I'm saying? Because our dwarf is facing us head on. Some of that.
I would say that exactly the opposite. You've got a strong silhouette of the dwarf, but it kills some of the details.
If I were to have a character in strong silhouette, I'd almost want to turn the head a little bit so that some of his facial features break up that silhouette. You know, and when I'm looking at the strong lighting, I'm tempted to have some reflected light. I would just say that maybe I would be tempted to throw in a secondary light source to give us some details into the on the dwarf and the creature. And I would be tempted to put a bit more texture into the Hook Horror. Gives the flesh some texture.
Well, I think this is a pretty early stage, right?
I don't know. I think this is a detailed drawing stage from the looks of it. He's past the rough stage. And he's in the detailed drawing stage, and I'd be tempted to show some of that texture.
I see that he's got kind of... The background is pretty nondescript at the moment, and I would push that in one of two directions. Either really go for a non-representational background that shows a bit of, you know, something that's more about action than about action and lighting and composition than about detail and depiction.
Yeah.
Or look at some reference material, because those rocks look like... Are those rocks or stalactites?
Stalagmites and stalactites, yes.
Those look like, you know what the background reminds me of? Mm-hmm. When I was about 5 years old, my mother used to go into some place or other, some shop, I can't remember what it was, and leave me outside. And right outside the shop, there's one of those cabinets that a fire hose is kept in with the metal doors, you know? The background looks just like the reflections of people walking by in the metal door. It doesn't really look like stalagmites at the moment.
Well, I can see why he might decide to lose focus on those in the background so they don't compete with the foreground, because the foreground is a very sharp detail.
No,
but
it's not a matter of focus.
Okay.
Even. You can have things rendered in a very basic style, but still have them look like what they're supposed to look like. But here it just looks like he hasn't observed what the forms of those things should look like.
Okay.
And he's put in what he thinks a stalactite and a stalagmite and a rock looks like. I mean, even the rocky area to the right of the...
Yeah.
What did you say that creature was called?
A Hook Horror.
A Hook Horror. It looks like a stick. It looks like a diseased stem of broccoli.
You're looking at the rocks, the rock
formations? Yeah, they look very soft, it looks like.
I would definitely be tempted to throw in a lot more texture into the rock surfaces. Especially, I mean, if you're going to leave... Well, I also noticed, for instance, one other thing that's kind of bugging me. I know that the Hook Horror has something it's sort of like... It is what passes as an opposable thumb.
What?
The Hook Horror, if you look at the right-hand claw,
Okay.
And you travel down it to that second stalagmite from the left.
Okay.
Or stalactite, I don't know which one is which. Anyway, you'll notice that there's a little, it's coming off the claw and being obscured off the back of the stalagmite or stalactite.
Sure.
Well, that's actually a thumb. That's like a claw thumb kind
of
thing. And unfortunately, it's creating a tangent with the that rock formation. It's being obscured by the rock formation, and they're blending into each other. It's kind of hard to notice if you're not familiar with what this creature looks like.
Yeah, I have no idea what that creature is. I like the creature. I think.
Oh yeah.
You know, if this were my picture, I would make the creature even. I would make the perspective, the foreshortening. I almost said forelongening there. I would make the creature even more prominent. I mean, as it is, the perspective. I'm not sold on the perspective right now.
Okay.
It looks kind of like the creature has a tiny little head. Maybe it does. Again, I have no idea what this thing is actually meant to look like.
The creature, according to the notes on the competition, the creature stands at about 10 to 12 foot in height, and the proportions are not off. I'd say the proportions are fairly close.
Right. Okay.
I
would say that given this perspective, the creature's head should be. I mean, the creature's head is like right up in the camera. The creature's head should be bigger. I like the framing, though. I will say that on the positive side, this is. The framing is really nicely done here. The way the creature's, is this its hands, its wings?
Those are like torso membranous pincers, and I like the way that frames the dwarf too. I have to agree.
Yeah, I like the way its pincers. First there's a circle. He's really got some nice circles going on here. First the hole in the cave behind the dwarf, then the dwarf's pose itself, then the pincers surrounding the dwarf, and then finally the outmost circle of the. Creature's outer spikes and the top of its the head area, but I don't know. I would give that head even more prominence and possibly turn it a bit more to the left so it doesn't obscure the dwarf. Also maybe just cheat on the lighting a bit. Give it more. So that the creature's popping out as much as the dwarf.
And one thing I noticed is the area of highest contrast seems to be between the dwarf's legs. If you notice where
why that is, though? That's to show that he has balls.
Yeah, he needs them if he's going to be taking on this creature single-handed,
yes.
Definitely.
Yeah, he is emphasizing the balls of the dwarf because the dwarf is using them right now.
My temptation would be to change some of the area of highest contrast to more of an area of interest rather than the area between the dwarf's legs, maybe up by the dwarf's head, would be a slightly better place to put that higher contrast. That's my thought. Just put that area, because your eye is going to be is usually drawn to areas of highest contrast, and I would use that tool to my advantage and put that behind an area that's much more interesting.
Yeah, you might want to move the dwarf's head down a bit if you're going to do that, because otherwise you'll have an area of highest interest right at the top of the composition.
Very true. There is a possibility there, yeah. You'd have to find some ways to play with the contrast to kind of guide the eye towards those areas of highest interest and see what that does for you. I know that guys like James Gurney in his book were very descriptive of a technique where you would actually put an area of much lighter tone behind, you know, to help frame faces, for example, to help to really help that. And I would say the secondary light source to help define the forms that are being lost to the shadows from due to the backlighting.
In fact, he has done that.
A little bit. He has indicated some detail in the shadows.
And he has got less deep shadows around the area of action. Mm-hmm. It's a bit difficult to say exactly where he's going with his general layout of lighting, as this seems like quite an early stage in the process.
So I guess what I would say in the end would be to visit more texture onto the creature, so that he's maybe somewhat more distinct from the rocks, and I would address that rock formation that obscures the hook horror's thumb, for lack of a better term, because it's creating a tangent that's rather flattening the scene.
One other thing with this monster, I would look at the muscle structure of creatures that have torsos. Because I'm not totally sold on the musculature there.
Well, I'm looking at it. He seems to be following the reference pretty well. I've looked at the creature. There was reference provided on the Art Order blog, and we can always link to that so people who are not taking part in this competition can have a look at it. I think he's fairly accurate to what the creature design is, but I think in terms of just certain things like adding texture, focusing the lighting, making strong use of the contrast to guide the eye, because right now it's lost a little bit because of the highest contrast being basically between the dwarf's legs. And
I told you he's focusing on the balls.
The balls. And as you pointed out, Sokar, definitely adding some more interest to the rock formations. And there's some really good reference out there. Heck, this month's issue of National Geographic features an article on some deep water caves, which are fairly interesting. You can see a lot of interesting detail and texture in those rock formations.
Yep. You could even put a photo texture there. I mean, you could either... Well, I wouldn't put a photo directly because it wouldn't make sense with this painting style, but for some quick and dirty texturing, you can use a nice high-resolution photo that hopefully doesn't have any JPEG artifacts or garbage like that. And in Photoshop, you know how there are layer compositing modes? Mm-hmm. You can do something like soft light or multiply. I don't know. Sorry, I haven't used it in a while. And that makes it sort of transparent over what you've got painted there. Mm. And then you can paint over it again. So you can take a little shortcut with your texture there if you want to.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'd say on the positive side, nice composition. I think it's being lost a little bit because of the lighting situation. That can be fixed, and the rock formation obscuring that claw, and a little bit of texture, and I think he's moving pretty well. Well, is there anything else you want to say? Do you have any other ideas?
I would say that maybe the one thing maybe is there could be a little more indication of movement.
Okay.
I mean, the dwarf's static pose isn't necessarily a bad thing. He's obviously posing on top of his kill.
Yeah, this is definitely the moment after.
I would have the creature's body a little more twisted. I'd leave its legs where they are and then have the torso twisted so it's half lying on its side. Mm. But that's kind of a minor, picky, annoying, and hard to do once you've got to this stage revision. It's the sort of thing an art director would do.
You know, one other thing, I'm noticing how the shield and the leg of the creature, the right hand, the right side leg of the creature, they're kind of melding together a little bit, which is not a negative. I mean, that can be an effective tool, but I'd almost be tempted to, since the shield is tilted in such an angle to the backlighting, maybe we could see more light to help further define the distinctness between the shield and the leg of the creature.
Yeah, you could have a ray of light coming in here, so there would almost be a white line between them.
Yeah, it might help address some potential flattening effect that we're having.
There's a lot of things you can do. You can really play with lighting a lot. I mean, this is you don't have to make it strictly realistic. Fun with it.
Yeah, I'm getting a much closer look now at this piece, and I really am digging I actually have to say, I do like the detail he's put in there, and the character is really interesting. Nice design and such. But I guess I'm concerned when you shrink this fella down.
Yeah, you can't really see all the detail he's put into the
Some of that
costume.
Awesomeness is going to get gobbled up by the size when it's printed.
Yep. But yeah, he's probably going to define some of that detail more and work in his... and his lighting.
But squinting at it, some really nice shapes. But I think we've had our I've certainly said my piece. It's a strong piece, and I hope that if anybody else has some comments to share with Preston, that they will share them on the blog, for instance, or send their comments to him. I'm sure he'd find that useful if they feel there's something we didn't cover here. He's off to a really good start. I look forward to seeing what the painting looks like.
Yeah, this is going to be good. It's
Ninja Mountain Podcast. Once a week, whether you need it or not.
And, well, is there anything you'd like to announce before we start signing off here?
Yeah.
What have you been up to?
Nothing. But you know what? I ate a Greek salad yesterday.
That's fascinating.
It tasted good.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing.
You're welcome.
I'm getting ready for a small local convention called OGCCon, which is being held in Nashua, New Hampshire. And I'll be furiously matting artwork before I go down there so that I can have something more presentable. I've got all this loose artwork, and I think it'd be nice to have the stuff matted properly now. So I'm working on that, and I've got my daily warm-up sitting here that I got to scan and post to my site. It's nice to be able to get back to those. But, well, anyway, thank you once again to everyone who's been listening, subscribing, leaving messages for us. Do make sure to check out the blog at ninjamountain.blogspot.com for show notes and further comments on this artwork. And if anybody else has any advice to share with Shane, feel free to chime in. And don't forget to check out the Visual Artist Podcast Network for other great shows out there. And thank you, Sokar, for joining us today.
Who's us?
Well, me. For joining me today. Otherwise, it'd just be Jeremy ranting into the microphone. And where can they find samples of your work? You're redeveloping your site, you said?
Yeah. My site should be done soon. I just have to figure out how to make the shopping cart look like the rest of my site. I'm using ZenCart, and it's making me feel very not Zen.
Uh-oh. It is harshing your zen-like mellow, huh?
It is harshing my mellow very much. Yeah. I feel very non-zen right now. I feel ripped off by the free site software I'm using.
That is indeed disappointing.
But I'm cheap, so I'm not going to pay for shopping cart software. And I get what I pay for, I guess.
Nice.
But I might just put up my site without it, as it's taking me a while to figure it out. I've got just about everything else done, and I haven't uploaded the front page. Mm-hmm. but for now, my work can be found at sokar.deviantart.com.
Well, good luck with the website redevelop. I know that can be a bit of a pain. And Let's see, and I'm Jeremy McHugh, and I can be found at McHughStudios.com, and I'm happy to say I'm back in the saddle with the daily warm-ups. I had some issues getting today because of my heart, my computer issue, but I think I've worked that out now, and we're back on track. And Gen Con is just around the corner, and if you guys are going to be there, don't forget to chime in on the comment section. I'd like to know who is going to be around, because I'll be conducting interviews for Gen Con, and I would certainly love to meet with listeners, and they can introduce themselves to their fellow listeners. Very cool. And, well, cue the music, Keishan.
Dun-dun-dun-dun. Would you like to be my friend on Facebook?
This show is part of the Visual Artists Podcast Network. Creative shows for creative people. Go to visualartistpodcastnetwork.com to find more great shows almost as good as this one.